Before we begin today's sermon, today's discussion, let us pay our homage to the perfect one, the supremely exalted one, the unvanquished one, the supreme Lord Buddha, by chanting the Namaskara 3 times. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. With the permission from the Noble Triple Gem. So let us start today's discourse on the Dhamma, which was uttered by the supremely exalted one, as you all know. So at this moment, I would like you, all of you, to remind the importance and the rarity, the scarcity of this kind of ministry of the Lord Buddha. And reminding so helps us to understand and realize which kind of an opportunity that we have, that all of us have got at this time. So with that help, it also helps us to reflect what kind of a teaching that we are reflecting day in and day out. Because it's very likely that we forget what kind of a opportunity that we have had after so long time. Therefore, according to the teachings of the Lord Buddha by himself, he asks his disciples to be reminded of this fact at least 3 times a day. Therefore, let us remind ourselves that the opportunity that we already have with an existing and thriving Sambuddha Sasana. In doing so, we give the due value to the Sasana as well as the opportunity that we all have as human beings. Because this is a very rare opportunity even the Devas and the Brahmas yearning to have. Therefore, you all are so fortunate ones, not only to get this opportunity, but also to listen to his words and to apply those teachings in your day-to-day life and realize the truth, what is happening in and around of this world. And what is this world to begin with? So let us discuss about this utmost truth. Okay. So as people who are already exposed to this truth, so I don't take this opportunity to go back to the real basics, because all of us are the intrinsic family members to here. So you're not foreign to this. So let us get our feet wet to the core basics of Dhamma. So our teacher, Most Venerable Guru Thero, has taught us how to interpret the world that we live in. What is understood by a sight? So let me revise you, all of you. How does this sight take place? And what do we understand by sight? And where does this sight take place? So it is very common understanding that the sight happens at the level of eye. So people just say that I see through my eyes. It's a very common utterance. But do you see through your eyes? Of course you do. But we are here to interpret that in a kind of a different way. Of course you need your eyes to see, otherwise you wouldn't be able to see. But does the sight happen at the level of eyes? So if that's so, just imagine a person who has got eyes with a dysfunction in the optic nerve or the retina. But the eye is still living. That means it gets the blood supply and has a full functioning venous drainage. That means the eye is living. All the cells in the eyes are working. They are living. Does that mean that he can see? If the neural pathway is blocked. So, if a doctor, if an eye surgeon examines him, he examines the eye, and depending on the findings or the signs, he comes to know where is the lesion. So along the pathway, if there is a compression on the optic nerve, so he can detect where the lesion is depending on the signs that he gets through his examination. Therefore, if the sight happened at the level of eye, that means at the retinal level, if the sight happened, it matters not what happens thereafter through the optic nerve. Then there are some things involved in the optic. So there's a thing called optic chiasma, where the two optic nerves come and the central nerve fibers decussate, and thereafter it is said as the optic tract. So it matters not what happens thereafter. If the retina functions, you should be able to see. But you know that it never happens. Then what the people believe is, okay, the sight doesn't happen at the level of eye, but it happens in the brain. That is what I also thought. So all these neural signals come to the brain, and that is when the sight happens. Even today, most of the scientists believe so. So let us clarify this. So if the sight happens at the level of brain, let us imagine this situation. So a hypothetical situation. Let's say there is a person who is unconscious, who is not, the consciousness is lost. Let's say that he is being brought to the hospital and now he is in the accident and emergency unit, waiting to be inspected or examined by a doctor. So the doctor, A&E, comes and examines him. So the first thing that he wants to exclude is, he is not dead. So the first sign that he looks for is the light reflex. That means he flashes a torch to one of the eye and examines the reaction of the pupil. You know, there's a small hole in the eyeball which is called the pupil. So normally what should happen is, when the light is flashed upon the eye, the pupils get contracted. That means the size of the pupil becomes smaller. And that this doesn't happen only at the eye which the torch is flashed. It happens in both eyes. So the doctor flashes the torch to one eye and looks for the constriction of the pupils in the both eyes. So this is the normal light reflex. So how does this happen? Are there any light sensitive cells in the pupil? There are no light sensitive cells in the pupil. The light sensitive cells are at the level of retina. That means it is beyond the pupil. It is much below the level of the even the lens, right? So when these light sensitive cells get the signal or the light, it starts a neural signal which goes through the optic nerve, then the optic chiasm, then optic tract, and then it comes to the brain. Then at the level of brain, there are very complex things happen. Then it decides whether the light which has entered to the eyeball is too much or too less, depending on that level. If the light, the intensity is too much, then it gives signals to another nerve, which is called the oculomotor nerve, right? The third cranial nerve. So the optic nerve is the second cranial nerve, and the oculomotor nerve is the third cranial nerve, so which gives a signal to constrict the pupils. Therefore, the both pupils are being contracted together. So this is how the light reflex is explained by the neuroscientists. So they already know. They have already discovered this piece of information. It has been proven. So it is very well described in all the neuroanatomy books. Therefore, the brain is in the middle of the pathway of the light reflex. That means the light enters to the eyeball, meets the retina, and from retina, the neural signal is initiated. Then it goes to the brain, and from the brain, it has been sent to the oculomotor nerve, and through the oculomotor nerve, it sends a signal to the both pupils to constrict the pupillary muscles, thereby making the size of the pupil smaller. So this is what happens in the light reflex. Then, for this light reflex to happen, all these conditions have to be met. What are the conditions? The light has to be in contact with the retina. Then retina has to function and ignite or the initiate that neural signal. That neural signal should reach the brain. That means along the pathway, there shouldn't be any obstacles. Then from the brain, the signal should be transducted to the third cranial nerve, and thereby the third cranial nerve should be intact, and all the branches of it. The pupillary muscles have to be intact as well. So all these conditions have to be met for the light reflex to occur. So did you see that the brain is in the middle of it? Without the brain, could this light reflex occur without proper functioning of the brain? So that means the functionality of the brain is necessary for this light reflex to happen. But the patient is unconscious. If we see through the brain, what should have happened? The signals already went through the brain. That means they should have seen the light. What do you expect? Would we be able to ask whether they saw the light? Now, of course, when the patient is unconscious, of course you can't ask because he's not conscious. He wouldn't even hear your question. So we'll wait until he wakes up out of his unconsciousness. That means when he's conscious, we'll ask, did you see that light? What would we say? We'll ask, what light? Which doctor are you talking about? Did the doctor get me for fun? They wouldn't remember anything. They would not know. So the sight hasn't happened. But the signal went through the brain. We are so sure of it. Otherwise the light reflex wouldn't have happened. So what do you think? Do you see through your brain? That means the brain is required. There's no question about it. My question is, does the sight happen at the level of brain? Is it the last receptor Is that so? The unconscious person also should have seen the sight. But he didn't see it. Why? Because the brain was not the final receptor. What do you think the final receptor is? Or the where do we get the experience from? It is through the mind. So there should be a communication between the brain and the mind. So we don't know how exactly that happens. But although we don't know, it happens. Otherwise you wouldn't be able to perceive the sight. So, the communication between the brain and the mind is temporarily, let's say, disconnected. When a patient is unconscious, that means the communication between the brain and the mind is temporarily disconnected. What if it gets permanently disconnected? That is what you call as the death. These things are very vividly explained in the Buddhist scriptures. Lord Buddha never talks about a death of a person. You know, in Vinaya, he really explains what is considered as death. He never talks about a death. That means maranang in Pali. He only refers to maranang as a part of the dukkha. But otherwise, he talks about the separation of the human body from the mind. That is not death. Death is a part of 11 great fires. There's a clear distinction between this. Of course, it is the Supreme Buddha. What can we say about it? Therefore, so the permanent separation or this permanent disconnection between the mind and the brain is what the death that the general population talks about. Can the mind die? Can there be a fixed mind to begin with to die? It never happens, right? But you can talk about the death as a feeling. That is true. But that feeling gives you suffering only if you are immersed in ignorance. Because the death happens as we speak. So, now we are sidetracking. So, let us come back to our main topic. So, the temporary disconnection between the mind and the brain is what unconsciousness is all about. Therefore, let's see how this perception is brought about. The eye and the light comes into contact and it initiates this neuronal response. And when the signal comes at the level of brain, it gives rise to some kind of a signal where the mind is receptive. So we'll call this as rupa-rupa. Let's say sight object. But we are going to talk about the generation of the mind. So there's no mind to begin with. But there is something called the root of the mind. So this root of the mind and the sight object, they come into contact with each other. That means they meet each other. Because of this contact, there's formation of the details of that contact. So I would like to give you an example or a simile for you to understand this. Let's say someone knocks at your door. So what comes to know first? You know that someone has knocked on your door. That means you detects it. You identify. I mean, you know that someone is at the door. Let's call it as detection. You detect it. Someone is at the door. Do you know who they are? You don't know it yet. Then you look at the camera. Or you look at that small lens. Or even through the keyhole. Whatever. Then you get to see them. Then you identify them. But do they know that you have identified them? Not yet, because you haven't opened the door yet. So next, the identification happens. With the detection that someone is at the door, as well as the identification, you can get an idea about who is at the door. But can you detect or can you identify without a person at the door? If you just go and see through the keyhole, will you see someone at the door? No. There should be someone waiting at the door for you to see. Then only, depending on that identification and detection, you open the door. You decide to open the door or not to open the door. Right? So the action, there's a formation of an action. So that's called the response. Then, with the response, it gives rise to the perception. So they are welcome to come inside. So this is what happens. So the same thing happens at the level of the mind, the root of the mind. First, the sight object, the sound object, or whichever the object, or the rupa, comes into contact with the root of the mind. Because of this contact, depending on the contact, now it is being detailed. What kind of a rupa is this? So first of all, it is detected. Something is contacted. So this detection, or we refer to it as registering, happens. So according to the Lord Buddha's words, it's called Vedana. Then the identification happens. There is Sanya. Then there is a response which follows, which is the Sankhara. So all these three kind of aggregates, so we call them as aggregates, are referred to as Nama. Then this Nama and Rupa comes together to form a perception, which is referred to as Vijnana. So this is how a Chakku Vijnana occurs. In a nutshell, I think all of you are clear about this process. So why am I talking about this? This is gibberish, right? There are lots of jargons in this. So why do we have to talk about this? Because to understand one basic concept, which is anicca. Otherwise, you'll be asking wrong questions and looking for answers. So let me explain this through a very simple example. Do you know how to clap? Of course you do. So you get your hands together and collide them with each other. When the collision happens, you can hear a sound. Now depending on this phenomenon, I'd like to ask you a question, very simple question. Where does the sound come from? I'll make it easier for you to answer. The sound comes from the hands. Isn't it? Right? The sound comes from the hands. So, in your minds, ask it from yourself, so that question is very clear and all of you understand. And there's a clear answer to that. Does the sound come from the hands? Of course, it does. If that's your answer, then there's a problem. If you say that, no, it doesn't come from the hands, if that's your answer, there's a problem as well. Okay, let me explain this to you. I will ask a question, the next question, if you say, no, the sound doesn't come from the hands, if that is your answer, I'll ask you another question. Okay, if the sound doesn't come from the hands, where does it come from? Okay, now I agree with you, the sound doesn't come from the hands. If so, where does it come from? Your answer, no, implies that the sound has to come from somewhere else other than the hands. So let us analyze this. So let me rephrase the question that I asked at first. That means, where does the sound come from? Let me rephrase it by adding the cause of the sound. So we know that the sound wave or the oscillations that were created as a result of the collision of the two hands is an effect of causes. So what is the cause for that? You know, the contact between the two hands. That means the collision, right? When they are collided together, it generates some oscillations in the air particles. So that is what we interpret as the sound wave. Sorry, the sound that we hear, which happens at the level of mind. That's a separate story. But for this example, let's just focus on the wave or the oscillations, right? So where does it come from? So that is our question to begin with. So let us add the cause of these oscillations to the question itself. That means, what is the cause? The collision of the two hands. So let me add that to the question. Before the collision happened, where was the sound? That is where it comes from, right? So where is it? Isn't that the same question? The question to begin with, the first question was, where does the sound come from? It came from the place where the sound was even before the collision happened. Isn't it? I mean, it is quite logical, right? The sound came from the place where it was stored even before the collision. So what did the collision do? It just emitted the sound from its source. It's like a water coming out of a water fountain, right? So if the hands is the source, the sound was there even before the collision, and the collision just made it emit through the hands. So is that what happened during the collision? That means sound was anyway there. So that means there should be another way of extracting this sound. Is there another way of extracting this sound? That means if you flash your hand like this, does the sound of a clap comes through? That never happens. Therefore, you know precisely that never happens. That means before the collision, you can never talk about a sound. The sound was not there before the collision. Therefore, it becomes a meaningless question. There's no sound to begin with before the collision. Therefore, we are asking about a non-existing sound. So, where does it come from? And where does the non-existing sound come from? That's a meaningless question, because that sound that we question about doesn't exist. It's like, what is the name of your brother that you don't have? Just imagine you don't have a brother. So someone asks you, what's the name of your brother? Then you are very polite and you say, I'm sorry, I don't have a brother. Okay, what is the name of your brother that you don't have? So if they keep asking about that kind of a question, Now you think that's so weird. That's a meaningless question. That question is wrong. So, because you are asking about something that doesn't exist, where does the sound come from? Now do you understand? That is a meaningless question. Okay. Then tell me, where does the rupa come from? It comes from the brain, right? So you have a question and you have an answer. Are you satisfied with that question and the answer? What do you think? Both the question and the answer is wrong. The question is wrong to begin with because you cannot talk about a fixed rupa. Right? So it requires the causes for the generation or the manifestation of the rupa. As you already know, there should be three aspects to it. Vipaka, ahara, nibbatilaka. So I'm not going to details about these jargons. You already know them. What you need to know, what we all need to realize is that it is just a manifestation, a momentary manifestation. Rupa is not a fixed entity. But we don't completely deny of that concept even. I mean, we don't say that there is no such thing as rupa. That is not what we are talking about. It manifests. It manifests then and there. Okay, we were talking about the sound of the clap. Can you remember? Okay, now I have another question to ask. Where does the sound go to? After the clap, where does it go to? So, before I asked, where does it come from? Now you said, that is a meaningless question. Now my question is, after the clap, after the collision of the two hands, where does it go to? What do I mean by it? The sound. What is your answer? Does it go without any boundaries? It goes until the infinity. I'm not talking about the wave. I'm talking about that oscillation, which just started. I mean, if you talk about a wave, of course, there is a concept which we talk about in physics, right? Waves transmit energy. I'm not talking about the wave. That particular oscillation, can you talk about that oscillation after the collision? The energy got transmitted to the surrounding particles, therefore a wave carried it there. I mean, that is what we call a wave is, right? The transmission of energy. Particles are not transmitted, but the energy is. So what can you talk about that particular oscillation? Can you talk about it after the collision? That particular oscillation? No. So where does it go to? Now do you realize that the question has become meaningless? Because that oscillation is not a fixed entity. It doesn't stay to go somewhere. It just vanishes. When the causes are no longer there, it doesn't manifest. So you can't talk about it after the collision. Therefore, that question also becomes meaningless. So this is what we have to realize. So where does the rupa come from? Where does the rupa go to? Both of these questions are wrong. But we can talk about a rupa. When can we talk about it? As long as the causes are met. Now there's another question that warrants another question. How long do the causes last? What do you think? Now you said that the effect would manifest as long as the causes would meet together. Now how long that causes would be met. That means how long a rupa manifests. What do you think? How long? Maybe few weeks, few days, or few hours, or a few minutes, few seconds. How long? So I'm asking about a duration of time. For you to measure the duration of time, what should happen? I mean, for that matter, let's say that if you want to measure a length, let's say the length of this whiteboard marker, there should be at least 2 points, right? A starting point and an ending point. So you measure the length from here to here. So there are 2 points. Therefore, you take a ruler and you measure the distance between these 2 points. What if I just give you just 1 point and I ask, okay, measure the length. I just give you one single point. Measure the length. Now, can you measure the length? That leaves a question. What length? Any length. Measure a length. Isn't it a meaningless question? Because you don't know, you don't have the 2 points in which that you want to measure the length. Therefore, unless you provide 2 points, can you measure the length? Can you measure the length of the single point? How long that point is? A single point. Is there a length for that? I mean, even if you measure the length of an atom, you still can get an idea because there are 2 points in the atoms, right? Because there are demarcations. Even at the I mean, if you know about how the physicists describe it, there are demarcations of the clouds of electrons. So it has at least nanometers or picometers. You will have an answer. But in one single point, is there a length? You cannot define a length. Likewise, if you want to measure the time, how many points of time do you require to measure the time? At least 2 points. That is when you are able to measure the duration of time. Between 2 moments of time. What if you just have 1 moment? Now measure the time. Can you? The concept of time just collapses. Because at 1 moment, it is just 1 moment. Is there a time for that? Are there demarcations at the beginning and the end of a moment? No, it is just 1 moment. Therefore, there's no duration. So it is timeless. A moment is always timeless. That doesn't mean that never occurs. That occurs at that time. Which occurs at that time? That occurs at that time. That means manifestation happens when the causes are met, when the causes are aligned. And how long does it last? That is out of the question. That is not a valid question. Because how long means a duration of time? That means the same causes have to be aligned for few more moments as well. Then only will you be able to measure the time. But you can't measure a time of 1 moment. If the causes are aligned only at that moment, how long does it last for? It doesn't last for any duration because you can't measure the duration within a moment. I hope that makes sense to you. Therefore, it is timeless. But that at that moment, we can talk about the manifestation, right? So Now we have identified three wrong questions. So what is the importance of identifying these questions as wrong? Because otherwise, if you don't identify them as wrong questions, you will be looking for answers to these questions. As if you are trying to find out the name of your brother that you don't have. Right? If you are looking for a brother that you don't have, what kind of a person do you think you are? Don't answer me, right? Don't answer to that question. So that is what you are looking for. If you are seeking for the source of rupa, if you are looking for where does the rupa go to? Or how long does the rupa last for? If you have answers to these questions, you just need to understand that this is not a correct question. These are wrong questions. So for example, let's say you have something very valuable that you consider as something very valuable. Let's say, for example, you have a wristwatch, a Rolex, right? So where did you get it from? From the store. A branded wristwatch. So you have a source. And now where is it? You may not have worn it because it's not nice to wear a Rolex to the monastery, right? People would judge me as I'm showing off my status. I don't want to do that, so I just left behind it and came to the monastery, right? So now where is it? It is in your home. And now still it is within your custody, that means you have it. So how long have you had it? Since the day I bought it until now, I have it. So don't you have answers to these questions? You do. Now we need to realize that these three questions are wrong. That means we don't say that, we don't deny the fact that Rolex doesn't exist. I mean, you can't deny that. Huh? Then you will ask me, then what did I see? That is not what we have to realize here. I mean, we are not denying the fact that what you experience. It is true what you experience. We don't deny the fact of the experience that you have. But we need to know, we need to apply the truth. So this application is known as applying the truth within the truth. So these truths are two different to each other. The first truth is the noble truth, or the truth that you realize through the teachings of the Buddha. And the other truth is your experience. That is also another truth. So you have to come into terms. Both of these are truths. Right? They have to match with each other. But they look as if they are worlds apart. So how do you match these two truths with each other? That is the challenge. So this is what we refer to as contemplation or meditation. That is why in our monastery, you will never find yourself being seated in cross-legged and having a deep breath in and a deep breath out. So there is some kind of thing like that. No offense, right? But we don't do it. Less common. I don't mean to say that we never do that. It's very less common. Because we are very interested about the very practical application of these teachings. That means seeing the truth through the truth. The second truth being your experience. The first truth is the truth which is taught by the Lord Buddha, which is the kind of a theoretical truth. Now, from the point where you understood the concepts of anicca, dukkha, anatta, right? Now they are established in your minds, but it is very difficult to apply into your day-to-day life because your Rolex is so real to you. And now we are talking about that real Rolex that exists. So I'm talking about a Rolex here. So you have to be wise enough to apply to your Rolex in your world. Your Rolex will be your son, your daughter, or your whatever the loved ones, or not only people, anything for that matter. So if you have taken those things or people for granted as fixed entities, this is where the teachings of the Lord Buddha comes for your rescue. So let us understand what these objects or people or whatever the fixed entities are. It is true, the experience that you have. How can you match the experience that you have within the truth of anicca, dukkha and anatta? This is what we need to understand, and this is the application of it. How does the perception of a Rolex is formed in your mind? You see it. So the sight happens. It is true that the sight happens. And we have been talking about it. So the mind is not a fixed entity to begin with. Therefore, when the sight happens, it just passes away. How else do you know that a Rolex is there? You see it, then. When you touch it, you can feel it. Even having your eyes closed, when you touch it, okay, you know that, oh, this is my Rolex. So, you get the perception of the touch. So both these pieces of information are important for you to recognize or to realize that the Rolex is really there. The perception of touch is also important. Interestingly, these two objects, or the sight object and the touch object, the minds are formed depending on these objects, as we discussed about the aggregation process. So, can these two phenomena happen in the same mind? That is against the theory that we learned, right? One mind can occur only through one object. That could be a sight object or a touch object. But the same mind cannot withstand two objects. But is that the way that you perceive it? First you see it, then you stop seeing it and you just feel it. Just imagine that your Rolex is within your hand. Now you're touching it. Is that the way how you experience it? You first see it, then everything goes blur and you feel it. Is that the way that you get the experience of your Rolex? No. You get both of these experiences at once. How is this possible? If these two phenomena happens with different minds, how do you get the feeling of both of these phenomena at the same time? One explanation to this problem, or one way of explaining this, is the mind is too fast. It rises and passes away very rapidly. Because of this rapid turnover of the mind, you experience the sight and the touch as if they happen together. This is a very common explanation. Do you agree with this? Okay, let me tell you this. This is agreeable if the observer is slower than the mind. Right? For example, let's say a ceiling fan. When it is just turned on, you will see the blades separately for some time until their speed exceeds the limit of the eye. Your eye also captures the frames in a, there's a limit that which can gets the there's a maximum rate at which it can capture the frames or the pictures, the images. So if this speed exceeds is exceeded by the speed of this fan, then you won't be able to see the blades separately. Then you will perceive a total blade which is made out of metal. But is there a metallic blade? I'm sorry, is there a blade, a total round blade which is rotating? No. There are three separate blades. But you won't appreciate that if the speed of the fan is more than the speed of the eye at which it captures images. So what is the observer here in the mind? It is your mind itself. So what is the rate or what is the speed of the mind in compared to another mind? Then you can't talk about it. Despite of the speed of the mind, you will experience them separately. Then now the same logic doesn't stand for. There should be another explanation for that. How does this occur? Even if it takes a total hour for a mind to rise and pass away, you wouldn't feel those two phenomena separately. Still, you will feel both at once. So now our question is, how does this occur? This occurs through the process of aggregation. So when a mind occurs, the details of the mind, that means the nama, or the vedana and sanya, or the registered and identified details, are being transferred to what is known as namagotta, or in general terms, memory. Then what happens is, this information which are transferred to namagotta can be accessed through the mind. That means mana. That's a completely different portal at which the mind generates through the thought objects. Thought objects are referred to as Dhamma Rupa, which are completely different from the other five kinds of rupas. The sight object, sound object, smell, taste and touch. Those five objects occur with the help of the sensory organs within the body, right? So there is a communication between the physical world and these sensory objects for these five rupas to occur. Therefore, so we are talking about the physical world, which is made out of four elements, four great elements. Now, with each of these minds, that means Chakku vinyana, sota vinyana, gana vinyana, jiva vinyana, kaya vinyana. That means sight, sound, smell, taste and touch. So when all this happen, each of the details of the nama, that means vedana and sanya, when they are transferred to the memory, thereafter it occurs the mana and dhamma, which gives rise to a mano vinyana. Here, what is the rupa? It is the Dhamma Rupa. So where does it come from? You know, that is a wrong question. How does it occur? What are the causes? You know that it comes, the causes are different now. The four elements doesn't directly relate to this. That means the same vipaka, ahara, nibbata, lagana, those three things matter. That is true. But what is ahara here? Is it the four elements? It is the memory which comes from the namagotta, right? Just the details. That means vedana and sanya, which was transferred, which was uploaded. Let's say like that, for easier explanation. They are being downloaded. Later on, not at the same time, but all the details are downloaded together. The details that happened at the level of, at the mind where the sight happened, and the details at which the touch happened, all of these pieces of information are being downloaded together. And the mind is formed, and a perception is formed. And at that perception, you perceive as if the sight and touch both happened at the same time. But did they happen at the same time? They never did. Although they never happened at the same time, you feel as if they happened at the same time. And it is to that particular perception that you refer to as the Rolex. Now tell me, I'm going to ask you one critical question. When the sight happened, just the sight, I'm not talking about the combined effect of the sight and the touch. When just the sight happened, did you see the Rolex? Or was it just a sight? It was just a sight. When did the Rolex happen? The Rolex happened only with the combined information. That means the sight and touch, all these information got combined to give rise to a combined perception, which you refer to as the Rolex. So, is it the Rolex that you first see? Or is it the Rolex of the sight you saw first? This Rolex was given rise only later. So which came first, the sight or the Rolex? The sight happened first. Which came first, the touch or the Rolex? The touch came first. Then how wrong would it be to interpret it is the sight of the Rolex or it is the touch of the Rolex? Because Rolex happened later. How wrong would it be to retrospectively define the causes depending on the effect? Do you get what I'm trying to say? So it is not the sight of the Rolex. It is the Rolex of the sight. It is the Rolex of the touch. That sounds meaningless. That sounds completely meaningless if you just first get to hear. Rolex of the sight? What does it mean? It's the sight of the Rolex. But you know what I'm trying to say. So then, try to see the world in this perspective. We are not trying to deny or defy the world that you experience. But in contrast, we are trying to see it under a different light. In which light are you trying to view it? In the light of Dhamma. So, who are your loved ones? I was just talking about the Rolex that you wear each day. Try to contemplate about the loved ones, about the properties or whatever that you can't help your mind to get away from. There is high time that you have been suffering for all this long. Don't be afraid. Try to reflect on the truth. Because it is the truth that we have to face one day. Unless you apply it now, you will have to apply it at some point in your samsara. Because it is the only way that this journey is going to be ended. So, if not now, later of course. So, we have to be quick enough. So do you know how long do you have to apply and to contemplate on these truths? We don't know. Still we have some time. At least we have a perception of time. Right? We never know when it's going to be late. So those were the last words of a Supreme Buddha. Handadani bhikkave amantayami vo. Vayadhamma sankara appamadena sampadeta. Can you just imagine? The Supreme Buddha, having preached for 45 long years, compared to other Lord Buddhas, that was a very minute time, of course. Having preached for that long, even the last words of a supremely enlightened one was those. So, let us be heedful. This is the utmost responsibility of towards ourselves. It is difficult. That is why we need to help ourselves by helping others. That is why you all come here, don't you? Because what you give is what you get. You already know that. That is why you help each other to understand and realize this. That is why you give the noble companionship to each other. So, you have ample amounts of opportunities to apply this within the monastery. So, that is why you are making the maximum use of it. So then, this is how we observe the world that we live in. So can you feel the chair that you are seated? Of course you do. Now, when I focused your attention, now you can see, you can feel it. And you can see it as well. From the corner of your eye, you get to see the chair. And you know that chair exists. Now you know how that perception happens. Is it the sight of the chair? Is it the touch of the chair? Or is it the chair of the touch? Or is it the chair of the sight? So try to interpret the world around you under this light. So then you will come to know, of course, sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, they occur at the mind. Thereafter, the combination of these pieces of information occur, and it is that pieces of information that I get to experience within the mind. Other than that, there are no objects as such. Okay, there's another interesting question that I want to ask from you all. Now we agreed how the sight happened. Initially we discussed about it, how chakku vijnana comes to, how that manifests. That is a process. There was a requirement for this process to begin with, which is the rupa rupa, or the sight object. And how does sight object comes into manifestation? It has some direct correlation with the four element world. That means ahara, vipaka ahara, then nibbati lakkhana. So the causes and the necessary environment and how they are matched together. Those are the three different things that are needed to for the manifestation to happen. Vipaka, ahara, nibbati lakkhana. Now the ahara is there, which is the four elements. That is the environment in which this rupa is manifested. That is the environment which is needed for the rupa to manifest. Now there's a direct communication, there's a direct requirement of the four elements for the chakku vinyana or the sight to happen. Now my question is, when the combination of the sight and the touch happened, when you experienced the Rolex, which is on your hand, you know that for the perception to be generated, there should be a rupa. Now, for the perception of Rolex, what is the rupa? What kind of rupa, which is made out of four elements, is required for the generation of the perception of Rolex? Let me rephrase the question. Now we know that for the generation of the perception, whatever the perception that is concerned, there is a requirement of a rupa, right? For the sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, for these perceptions to occur, there's a direct communication between the four elements. That means the rupa which has direct relationship with the four element is required. Now, my question is, when you experience the Rolex, there is a perception, you know. What kind of rupa which is dependent on four elements is required for this generation of this perception? Is there a four element Rolex in the physical world? Or four elements are there and the sight happened? Four elements are there and the touch happened in two separate minds. And depending on these, the information or the details, Vedana and Sanya, when they are uploaded, only they are being downloaded without the rupa, without the sight object and the touch objects. Just the details are downloaded for the perception of Rolex to be created. Are you with me? So is there any correlation with the four element world? What do you think? Direct communication? Indirectly, yes, of course. Indirectly, the sight happened depending on the four elements. The touch happened depending on the details of the four elements. Indirectly, of course, I agree with you all. But is there a direct relationship or the direct Rolex which is made out of four elements? Is there something like that? There's no such thing. Do you understand? So, a perception warrants a rupa. Is that true? That is true for this sight, sound, smell, taste and touch. That could be true for them. But for the manovijnana or the mental perceptions, is this true? Is this the truth? Is there a direct communication between the four elements for the mental perception to happen? Or just the memories of the Dhamma Rupa? One Dhamma Rupa signifies could be many thousands and millions or billions of memories. Right? Therefore, there is no Rolex which is made out of four elements to begin with. This is what we were referring to. There is no such thing as the pudding. It is just flour, sugar, plums, and all the ingredients. Is there a separate thing called pudding? How can you separate the pudding from the ingredients? You can't separate things like this. It is the same thing. Can you extract the perception of Rolex out of its ingredients? What are the ingredients? The sight and the touch. Just the details of it. Nama. Those are the ingredients. So can you separate those two ingredients? So what will be left with if you separate those two ingredients? Will you have a separate Rolex? No. Well, this is what we need to understand. The Rolex that you perceive is the effect of combination of the sight and the sound. Sorry, the sight and the touch. So, how long that perception lasts for? That is the third wrong question. So, how long have you been having your Rolex? If you have an answer, now you know that you have answered a meaningless question. So, it looks like when you are in the mental asylum, you come across different people with different personalities. You may find the Jesus Christ. You may even find the Lord Buddha. And you may find doctors who treat patients. You may find several well-renowned engineers or the scientists. If you want to win their hearts and talk with them, if you want to just be with them, if you come across the Jesus Christ, you will of course have to address them as Lord Jesus. Otherwise you can't live and win their heart. So, therefore, since we have already been born in this world, you will have to use the same words. Otherwise people won't understand what you say. But in your minds, you have to interpret the world that you experience in the correct sense of light. That is why we talk about this Dhamma. You don't have to talk about in the actual wisdom, because you can't. If the Lord Buddha was able to do that, he would have done that. But which length did he go up to? He said the true nature of this world as anicca. That means not fixed. He went as far as that. Doesn't that warrant a question? For example, let's say, I'm going to give you a fruit. And I say, this fruit is not a banana. Now, do you agree? Do you accept? Okay. Now, you eat that fruit and say, oh, this not a banana fruit is so delicious. What is the name of this fruit? Not a banana. Because you never bothered to ask the question. So when I said that, this is not a banana. Then you never bothered to ask, okay, if this is not a banana, what is this? That is why you say, this not a banana is so delicious. So the Lord Buddha says, the true nature of this world is not fixed. If you agree with that, okay, the true nature of this world, what is the true nature? Not fixed. Doesn't that leave a question behind? What is the question? If it is not fixed, what is it? But there's no answer to that. That is why you need to realize through your wisdom, because it is only through words that Lord Buddha has preached the Dhamma. The words can reach only as far as that. The rest is to be realized through your wisdom. Because it is not fixed. What is not fixed? Can you comment on that? What is not fixed? What itself means a fixed entity. So if you have an answer to that, that is again a fixed entity. That is why the true essence, the true core of this Dhamma can only reach as far as that. That word, anicca. Not fixed. What is not fixed? That is out of the question. I hope you reflect on these truths within your truths. Right? The first truth is the truth which is preached by the Lord Buddha, the teachings, the noble truths. The second truth is your experience, the world that you experience, or the vipaka. If you are trying to match these truths together, you will experience a beautiful, relaxed world. You will be awed to that. You will say, oh, pubbe ananussute su dhammesu chakkhun udapadi. You will say these words truly, honestly. It is the same world that you experience. There's no difference as far as the experience is concerned. But the light at which you interpret the world that you experience will be totally different. And under that light, the world would look so different. And you have never seen the world under that light. That is why you say, Pubbe ananussute su dhammesu chakkhun udapadi jnanam udapadi panya udapadi vijja udapadi aloko udapadi. Can you just imagine that moment where a supreme Buddha has achieved this enlightenment and unearthed this truth for the first time in this world? And when the devas and the brahmas, they were rejoicing in this atmosphere. So that is a triumphant moment for all of us. That is why it gives a shiver down your spine when you are reminded of that moment, because we are still experiencing the blessed moments which started from that moment onwards. So try to reflect your world under this light. Thereby, you won't be looking for answers for wrong questions. The wisdom is realizing wrong questions as wrong. That is the only answer that can be given to a wrong question. Is there any other answer? What is the name of your brother that you don't have? How old is he? And what does he do? So, what is the question? What is the answer to all these questions? The realization of these questions are wrong. Otherwise, you will still be looking for answers. If you consider these questions as valid questions, can you stop yourself from looking for answers to these wrong questions? That is why we are still looking for answers for meaningless questions. That is why we are looking for a source of pleasure. Pleasure, when it is considered as an entity, you are looking for a source. So can you name few sources of pleasure? For some, that could be watching movies or playing a game or hanging around with your friends or going around the world, visiting the places that you have never been before, or enjoying your favorite dish, or having a piece of pizza. So these could be sources of pleasure. But if you apply these concepts of the teachings of the Buddha, now you realize that there are no sources, but there is a cause for pleasure. There are causes for pleasure. What is the cause for pleasure? Release of vexation. It is the reduction of the vexation itself is experienced as the pleasure. But if that pleasure that you experience is something beyond that experience, that means, okay, let me ask this question. What is created in the mind when the vexation is reduced? What is created in the mind when the vexation is released? What is created? Pleasure. Do you agree? Don't fall for the traps that I set. Is something created in the mind when the vexation is released? Is something separate created, or just the vexation is released? Okay, let us understand through another simile. Have you seen darkness? Do you know what darkness is? Yes, you have seen darkness. Right? So, your answer is yes if I ask that question in that way. Let me emphasize one word in it. Have you seen darkness? Have you seen darkness? What is there in darkness for you to see? What is darkness after all? It is the absence of light. It is the inability to see. So have you seen the inability to see? What can you see in the inability to see? Let me rephrase it. Let's say, okay, let's these lights that is turned on in this room. Let's say there is a dimmer that is connected to these lights. When we dim the intensity, now you will say that, oh, the room is getting dark. The room is getting dark. Now my question is, what did the room get? You said the room is getting dark. What did the room get as darkness? Did the room get something or did the room lose something? The room lost light. The intensity of the light was reduced. So yes, we agree, something got reduced. What was added to the room? What is added? Darkness is added. Can you measure that darkness? Can you pinpoint and say this is the darkness? But people still talk about darkness. That means it has to be real. Would people talk about something that is completely absent? No. You also talk about darkness because you feel it. Where do you feel it? To your mind. Of course, feelings are felt to the mind. Do you have any doubts? Have you seen a feeling? What color is it? Have you seen a feeling fallen on the ground? No, feelings are felt in the mind. So darkness is a feeling. So what is there in the physical world for the feeling of darkness to happen in the mind? That is something which is absent. What is present in the physical world for that feeling to occur in the mind? You can't say that absence of light is present. I mean, absence of light is absent. Right? It is not something which is present. Do you get my point? What is present in the physical world for the generation of the perception of light in the mind? Is there anything? There is nothing. Then what is darkness? Beyond that perception, is there anything specific in the physical world that you can pinpoint and say, this is what darkness is? Okay, now you talk about sources of light. These are sources of light. Electric lights, which are turned on, they emit light. A lit candle, a lit lamp is a source of light, or the sun is a source of light. Have you seen a source of darkness from which darkness is emitted? If you bring a source of darkness to a well-lit room, the whole room will be immersed in darkness. Is there some source of darkness that you know? What do you think? Have you ever come across such a source of darkness? How about a black hole? Does it emit darkness? No, it just extracts all the light energy. It doesn't leave behind any light even. It absorbs all the light. That is why it is called as a black hole. It doesn't emit darkness. So there are no sources of darkness because there can't be any. Because darkness is the absence of it. Darkness cannot be defined as far as the physical world is concerned. But darkness is a failing. Like the mirage. Have you seen a mirage? Of course you have seen a mirage. But have you drunk water of a mirage? Why not? Haven't you seen water of a mirage? I mean, haven't you got the feeling that water exists in a mirage? That feeling is true, right? There's nothing wrong with that feeling. You perceive as if a pool of water is there in the mirage. But although you have that feeling, do you get deceived through that perception? No, you know this is a mirage. The water doesn't exist there. Therefore, you don't go behind it, however much thirsty that you are. You don't waste your energy running after a mirage, because you are convinced that not even a drop of water can be found in the mirage. Because of that conviction, your energy is not wasted. You don't go behind something cannot be found. But what if that perception deceives you? If you are thirsty, you will go after it. Therefore, if you are thirsty for pleasure, what will happen? Will you be able to stop yourself from running behind the sources of pleasure? You are not running behind it. It is the attachment that makes you driven. You cannot stop yourself. The only way to stop this vicious cycle is the conviction. For the conviction to happen, you need to contemplate. You need to match one truth with the other. I hope this makes sense to you. So, this is just, I can talk about various examples, but it is only you who know about yourself, about the way that you interpret your own world. And if that interpretation goes wrong at some moment, there onwards you will start to suffer. The 11 great fires will occur. That is unstoppable because it started from the point where the false interpretation started. Therefore, don't worry. We fail. That is the way that we learn how to walk. When you are born, did you know how to walk? You couldn't even raise your head up. It took you 3 long months for you to learn that specific skill. That is the normal developmental age at which a child learns how to raise his head up and see the world straight. Until then, the little newborn baby is so flaccid. It's like a floppy baby, floppy doll. It cannot raise its head. So even for the raising of the head took you 3 long months. How long do you expect you to see this world in the correct light? What do you think? Don't be afraid to fail. Whenever you fail, learn from your mistakes. That is how we learn. So if that's the case, actually you should be happy to find you have failed because you will learn a new lesson. So when a child learns to walk, he first will stand with support. He will get hold of something, then he will take some energy and would stand himself up. He will be properly be seated on his own legs. Then what happens when he loses of the thing that he holds? He will fall back again. He may cry for a few hours because he hurt himself. But the second time when he gets up, he has this experience. Okay, I can fall back again if I lose the hang of this. With that experience, he gets up again. And he might fall back again. But this time, that experience is confirmed. Okay, I should not let this go. I have to hold this on. This is how the little baby learns to stand up on its own. After some time, he learns how to stand up without support. When the muscles are strong enough, when the muscles of the legs can bear its own weight, then he is able to stand up without support. And what made the muscles strong? What do you think? If he didn't stand up with support, would the muscles get strong enough? No, it is because he fallen, because he fell. That made the muscles strong. That made him able to stand up again. So those repeated exercises made the muscles strong. What if he just gave up? You know what? This is enough. I can't walk. If he gave up at that point, would the muscles be strong enough? And would we be able to stand up without support? No. There's a very famous quote. Inside every mistake is a gem of wisdom. Indeed, it applies to the practice of the path. Inside every mistake that you do, there is a gem of wisdom. It's okay to fail. Don't try to define who you are through your mistakes. Forgive yourself as much as you do for others. Have you forgiven yourself? Sometimes people are engulfed within a lot of grief because they consider themselves as so wrong. They are engulfed with the guilt because they truly consider that I have done this. You still haven't forgiven yourself. But true to your heart, try to answer this question. If someone like you, if someone who is exactly like you came to you and just confessed what they have gone through, what would you have said to them? Wouldn't you have said, it's okay. You still have hope. You have the blessing of this sasana. You haven't done the heinous sins. Still you have hope. Wouldn't you say these things to them? But have you been able to say those words to yourself? For some of you. Therefore, forgive yourself first. Don't try to define yourself through your mistakes. This actually happens when you can't forgive the others, because it takes one to know one. Therefore, forgive. Accept that things can go wrong. And when you realize this, you will forgive yourself and start forgiving others. And there onwards, you'll be able to apply this concept into your day-to-day life. If this doesn't happen, you can't even start applying these things. You'll be engulfed within the guilt and the grief or the fear. First of all, the mind has to be very relaxed. A huge amount of merit is consumed for this relaxed mindset to occur. That is why our teachers always ask us to engage in merits as much as we can. As a matter of fact, we will never be overdosed with merits. That is the only thing that you cannot be overdosed. Even the water that you consume, that can be overdosed. There's a lethal amount of water. When you consume beyond that limit, even the water could be poisonous. But merits, they can never be overdosed. Because the merit is another name for what? The pleasant mindset. If we want to be happy, do merits. But that is not the supreme bliss of Nibbana, right? Don't get me wrong. But if you want to be happy until you attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, do merits. It matters not what we have been doing through all this long along the samsara. We might have consumed a lot of sins in our past. Thankfully, our teachers, all the noble companionship that you get, they don't define you through your mistakes. They define you who you are today, what you are trying to do today. If you have devoted yourself, your entire life, for the attainment of the supreme bliss of Nibbana, you are a totally different person from the rest of the world. That is why an environment like this is mandatory for the practice of this path. Beyond these gates, I can't even imagine how people live. That is why I can't even imagine what kind of a life that you're going through. Because you have to show a different life to the world, but still you realize what is the truth within. It's like living a lie. But still, you have to keep on doing that for the benefits of the others. Otherwise, they will call you have gone nuts, as fools, as awkward lunatics, as some people call us. We are very used to that. Therefore, there is a different interpretation, but there is such interpretation as well. But if you know that is not the true interpretation, then reflect on the truth. When you get the idea of the truth, you can only see the world through the truth. Can you unrealize something that you have realized? What do you think? Now you have, let's say, you have realized what is a mirage. Having realized the truth behind a mirage, can you run after it? How? What do you need to do to run after a mirage? For water, of course. Right? Having realized what a mirage is, can you do that? Can you unrealize what you have realized? That is never to happen. But you will have to run behind it just to show off to the others, just because you have to live within the community. You just have to show them, I'm also running. Right? Behind what? Behind that pit full of water that you also are running behind? You will have to run. That is why I told you, it is like living a lie. I can't even have imagined myself being lay while having realized the truth. It's impossible. It's impossible. But I don't mean to say that you should be struggling with that. Right? I struggled a lot. Then I just gave up. That is why I'm here. Where I can get the association of the supreme people on this earth. Can you imagine the opportunity that I have here? Every word I utter here is thank towards my teachers. Not even a word is mine. So, you also can say the same thing. We are ever so grateful towards our teachers. If not for them, we cannot experience the freedom that we experience now. That is why you say from the bottom of your heart, Swagatam vata me asi, mama buddhasa santike. Rejoice in that feeling. That is the most triumphant feeling that you have ever got in the infinitely long journey of samsara. And try and make the others that you love, that you care for, make the same comment about their life as well. Try to make them engaged in the merits, because it takes a huge lot of merits for them to experience what you experience right now. Therefore, let us spread the good news all around the world. It is already happening. So, we receive emails from all around the world that this change is happening to them. Can you imagine? People in the far, far beyond, or many kilometers away. The change that happened within your life, that has begun to happen within them as well. Sooner or later, this monastery is going to be filled with them. Then we are counting the days until that happens. We are keeping our fingers crossed. We are waiting for you. So on that note, I think we can conclude our discussion for today. There's a small announcement. So the next week, the next Saturday, there's going to be an ordination ceremony. So for that reason, the morning session, as usual, we are not going to have it because of the ordination ceremony. So you can experience the triumphant moment of 13 young men who have given up all their lay attitudes and entering the brotherhood of the monks. So you can rejoice in that feeling. You can be happy for them, as you have always been. Let us take a moment to transfer the merits we have all acquired by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, listening to Dhamma and engaging in various meritorious deeds today. First and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching. And with immense gratitude, let us transfer these merits to the bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who since time immemorial have protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Lord Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us also transfer the merits that we have acquired to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief relators of all of the chapters who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and who have committed themselves to the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us not forget that among them are the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer these merits to Guru Swami Dhanse as well as all other monks resident at this monastery, as well as the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to express our gratitude to those who have made great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these sermons, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. May through the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, may they redeem from the woeful plains and be born in the blissful plains. May through the power of these merits, may they abstain from unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer these merits we have acquired to our devotees, friends of the monastery, who for the sake of merits continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who have contributed to the construction of the monastery, to those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicine, as well as those of you who have passed on their know-how and extended their well-wishes. May through the power of these merits, they abstain from unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer the merits to our mothers, fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our elders, friends and acquaintances, employees and employees, and to all those who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. By the power of these merits, may they heal of any physical and mental ailments. May they overcome many obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deed, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let's also take a moment to transfer these merits to devas, brahmas, spirits, and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all other numerous gods and deities who are committed to protect and fulfill the Sambuddha Shasana. Let's also remind ourselves and transfer our merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and help us out of harm's way. May through the power of these merits, may they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deed, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let's also take a moment to transfer these merits to our ancestors who have predeceased us, to all those who have been our families, friends, and acquaintances in this infinite long journey of samsara, who have helped us, supported us, and assisted us in any way they could. Let us transfer these merits. Let us also transfer these merits from the members of armed forces as well as the police force, who have sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation. May all who have lost their lives in war, be their friend or foe, rejoice in the merits that we have acquired today. Let us also transfer these merits to all those who have lost their lives in natural calamities such as tsunamis, earthquakes, landslides and pandemics, reminding ourselves that among them will be those who have been friends and family to us in this long journey of samsara. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to them. May through the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, may they redeem themselves from the woeful plains and be born in the blissful plains. May through the power of these merits, may they abstain from unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Finally, let us resolve that may through the power and the blessing of all the merits that we have acquired today, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds and thousands of Arhants on this blessed land. And finally, may through the power of the blessings and the merits that we have acquired today, you and I and everyone who have helped to make this program a success become an Arhat Unvanse or Arhat Mehinvanse in this very life itself and in the era of Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all.